Episode 67. 52 bags of refuse. One for each week of the year. Four kinds of violets on the bridge. One for each season. Greetings and welcome into the Patuxet General. I am your host, Jess. The beginning of May brings serious showers this week, flowers, and hopefully a spicy margarita. Our dish this week is the very tasty and local Johnny Cakes. Served sweet or savory, you will love them. But first, I must thank our Patreon subscribers. These victory garden building folks are the hand-tilling, fertilizer-toting, careful seed-selecting, and diligent weeding and watering that brings the rainbow vegetable bounty that is the Patuxet General, without whom we would merely be last year's empty tomato hoops. So thank you. And if you would like to support the program, get a shout-out and extra content, check out our page on patreon.com or simply follow the link in the show notes. And thank you if you do. But first, who's up for Johnny Cakes? We mentioned Kenyon Mills last week while we were talking about clam cakes in episode 66, but we did not talk about what they are most famous for, Johnny Cake meal. They have this to say about the dish made from the meal. We are best known for our genuine stone-ground cornmeal, especially stone-ground white cornmeal or Johnny Cake meal, to make Johnny Cakes. This traditional Rhode Island food dates back to the colonial time when Native American Indians introduced corn to the settlers. At first, they were known as Journey Cakes. Settlers often took them on journeys. The R eventually got dropped and Journey Cakes became Johnny Cakes. There are many versions of this recipe that I have seen, but the honest-to-goodness Kenyon one goes like this. Basic Rhode Island Johnny Cake Recipe, Dick Donnelly, Saunderstown, Rhode Island. For this you will need 1 cup Kenyon's white cornmeal, 1 teaspoon sugar, 1/2 teaspoon salt, and 1 1/4 to 1 1/2 cups boiling water. Step 1. Gradually add between 1 1/4 to 1 1/2 cups boiling water to about 1 cup of your dry mix, mixing with the back of your spoon until the meal is moistened, and then use the bowl of the spoon to continue mixing. You know the consistency is right when there is a loose plop of batter off the spoon. Step 2. Well oil a hot griddle at 340 to 380 degrees. Use a well-seasoned cast iron griddle or Teflon or Tefal one. Do not use cast aluminum or the cakes will stick. Step 3. Spoon batter onto the griddle, 1 spoonful to a cake. Tap the spoon in the griddle to release batter from the spoon to control the shape of the cake. 1. Adjust the size of the cake by changing the size of the spoon. Ice teaspoon, small, tablespoon, larger. Leave cake undisturbed until it becomes brown around the edges and firm. Then leave a little longer. Place a few drops of corn oil on top of each cake before turning over. Turn the cake over and pat down lightly to keep uniform thickness. This side doesn't need quite so much time to brown. Don't be afraid to press them down. When done, remove to a platter. Step 4. Place several large spoonfuls of softened whipped butter, found in our dairy case, into a cup. Add some real maple syrup to the butter and mix very well by slicing the butter with the side of the spoon until mixed, and then stirring until smooth and sauce-like. Spread small amounts of the maple butter on each cooked cake. At time of serving, use the back of the butter spoon as your spreader. Step 5. Eat with your fingers and enjoy. After some practice, the fun begins. Try adding something to the batter and try adding something to the butter for an endless variety of delicious combinations. For example, use a finely grated orange zest in the batter and a splash or two of Grand Marnier in the butter. B, chopped shrimp or lobster in the batter and a squirt of Tabasco sauce in the butter. C, a finely chopped onion in the batter and a small amount of grated horseradish in the butter. Johnny Cakes can be served without butter. Try a little drizzle of coffee syrup, honey, or molasses. Drizzle a small amount of molasses on the platter, a fine squiggle will do. Put the cakes on the platter and then drizzle some honey on the tops. Serve warm. You may want to avoid serving butter and maple syrup on a hot Johnny Cake to first-time eaters, particularly to children, as the taste and texture may surprise or disappoint someone who is expecting a pancake. Serve the first cake just plain, and be sure to call it journey bread or cornbread, and then dress it up later. These are so tasty, you couldn't help but enjoy. Last year at this time, episode 23 if you are interested, we took a look at the classic simple margarita. And if that's the way you fly, please feel free to look it up. But this year, I've got a little more spice. So let's heat up this Cinco de Mayo with a spicy margarita. Food and Wine has this to say about the matter. Cocktail historian and master mixologist Dale DeGroff traces the margarita's humble origins back to Tijuana's Agua Caliente racetrack, where the cocktail known as the Tequila Daisy served as early as the 1920s. The racetrack's take called for tequila, lemon juice, and a sweet ingredient, making it the perfect precursor to the modern-day margarita. And while it's hard to pinpoint why the spicy margarita is such a popular riff on the classic, there's no denying that people really love hot sauce. Nowadays, bartenders are continuing to test the margarita's potential by getting creative with rims, using everything from Hatch green chili salt to black lime and chili flakes, both of which add striking color and complexity to the final product. For a spicy margarita in particular, we prefer to use the classic Mexican seasoning salt, Tajin, which is made from a blend of dried ground chili peppers, lime, and salt. The brilliant red color teases the flavor profile of the drink, and the chili notes it adds to the rim complement the jalapeno flavor perfectly. And although the spicy margarita calls for an additional step, muddling jalapeno coins inside the shaker, relative to the classic recipe, it's still important not to cut corners by using a pre-made margarita mix, which often contains high fructose corn syrup as well as artificial coloring and flavoring agents. Tempting as it may be, it's also worth using freshly juiced real lime juice, not the bottled stuff you can find at the grocery store, which typically involves more lime oil. For Food & Wine's spicy margarita, you will need 1.5 ounces Blanco tequila, such as Magenta tequila, 1 ounce of Cointreau, 3/4 ounce freshly squeezed lime juice, and 1 jalapeno pepper sliced into coins. Step 1 to rim your glass, rub a lime wedge around the opening and dip into your seasoning. Step 2, add 2 or 3 jalapeno coins to a cocktail shaker and muddle. Step 3, add the tequila, Cointreau, lime juice, and ice to the shaker and shake well. And step 4, strain drink into a glass and top with 2 jalapeno coins for garnish. And enjoy your independence from the regular tasty drink. Looking for an opportunity to hang out with the Patuxent General crew? How about play some of those pinball machines you've been hearing about? Not to mention pizza strips to benefit the kitchen mission at the Edgewood Congregational Church. Well, check out our Gaspy Fringe Fun Fair. The fair is Saturday, May 27th, from 9 until 2. There will be vendors with food and crafts, a build-a-clam workshop for the little ones, and electromagnetic pinball is going to blow your minds with all the games. Is that enough? No! There will also be a huge thrift shop yard sale. Jewelry, clothes, household goods, and books. Something for everyone. The Gaspy Fringe Fun Fair takes place Saturday, May 27th at the Edgewood Congregational Church from 9 till 2 p.m. I'll be there all day serving up pizza strips from the Kitchen Mission. Bring your questions and I'll have answers. So meet us there. I want to tell you about my friend Mike and his Electromagnetic Pinball Museum and Restoration Arcade. It's an all-inclusive place to relax and share anything related to modern pinball, EM pinball, and arcade games. A group of pinball and arcade fans with an addiction to games of all kinds and Lego too. $10 gets you free play on pinball and arcade games all day. You can find them at 881 Main Street, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or online at www.electromagneticpinballmuseum.com. And now, in our House on the Corner series, the continued reading of The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft. Thank you. The vault was very deep in the foundations of the priory, and undoubtedly far down the face of the beetling limestone cliff overlooking the waste valley. That it had been the goal of the scuffling and unexplainable rats I could not doubt, though why I could not tell. As we lay there expectantly, I found my vigil occasionally mixed with half-formed dreams, from which the uneasy motions of the cat across my feet would rouse me. These dreams were not wholesome, but horrible, like the one I had had the night before. I saw again the twilight grotto, and the swineherd with his unmentionable fungus beasts wallowing in filth. And as I looked at these things, they seemed nearer and more distinct, so distinct that I could almost observe their features. Then I did observe the flabby features of one of them, and awaked with such a scream that the old cat started up, and whilst Captain Norreys, who had not slept, laughed considerably. Norreys might have laughed more, or perhaps less, had he known what had made me scream. But I did not remember myself until later. Ultimate horror often paralyzes memory in a merciful way. Norreys waked me when the phenomena began. Out of the same frightful dream, I was called by his gentle shaking and his urging to listen to the cats. Indeed, there was much to listen to, for beyond the closed door at the head of the stone steps was a veritable nightmare of feline yelling and clawing, whilst the old cat, unmindful of his kindred outside, was running excitedly around the bare stone walls, in which I heard the same babble of scurrying rats that had troubled me the night before. The acute terror now rose within me, for here were anomalies which nothing could well explain. These rats, if not the creatures of a madness, must be burrowing and sliding in the Roman walls that I had thought of to be solid limestone rocks. Unless perhaps the action of water through more than 17 centuries had eaten winding tunnels which rodent bodies had worn clear and ample. But even so, the spectral horror was no less. For if these were living vermin, why did not Norreys hear the disgusting commotion? Why did he urge me to watch the old cat and to listen to the cats outside? By the time I managed to tell him, as rationally as I could, what I thought I was hearing, my ears gave me the last fading impression of the scurrying, which had retreated still downward, far underneath this deepest of subcellars, till it seemed the whole cliff below was riddled with questing rats. Norreys was not as skeptical as I had anticipated, but instead seemed profoundly moved. He motioned to me to notice that the cats at the door had ceased their clamor, as if giving up the rats for lost, while the old cat had a burst of renewed restlessness and was clawing frantically around the bottom of a large stone altar in the center of the room, which was nearer Norrie's couch than mine. My fear of the unknown was at this point very great. Something astounding had occurred, and I saw that Captain Norreys, a younger, stouter, and presumably more naturally materialistic man, was affected fully as much as myself, perhaps because of his lifelong and intimate familiarity with the local legend. We could, for the moment, do nothing but watch the old black cat as he pawed in decreasing fever at the base of the altar, occasionally looking up and mewing to me in that persuasive manner which he used when he wished for me to perform a favor for him. Norreys now took a lantern close to the altar and examined the place where the old cat was pawing, silently kneeling and scraping away the lichens of centuries which joined the massive pre-Roman block to the tessellated floor. He did not find anything, and he was about to abandon his efforts when I noticed a trivial circumstance which made me shudder, even though it implied nothing more than I had already imagined. I told him of it, and we both looked for its almost imperceptible manifestation with the fixedness of fascinated discovery and acknowledgement. It was only this, that the flame of the lantern set down near the altar was slightly but certainly flickering from a draught of air which had not before received, and which came indubitably from the crevice between the floor and the altar, which Norreys was scraping away the lichens. We spent the rest of the night in the brilliantly lighted study, nervously discussing what we should do next. The discovery that some vault lay deeper than the deepest known masonry of the Romans underlay this accursed pile. Some vault unsuspected by the curious antiquarians of 3 centuries would have been sufficient to excite us without any background of the sinister. As it was, the fascination became twofold, and we paused in doubt whether to abandon our search and quit the priory, forever in superstitious caution, or to gratify our sense of adventure and brave whatever horrors might await us in the unknown depths. By morning, we had compromised and decided to go to London to gather a group of archaeologists and scientific men fit to cope with the mystery. It should be mentioned that before leaving the subcellar, we had vainly tried to move the central altar, which we now recognized as a gate to the new pit of nameless fear. What secret would open the gate? Wiser men than we would have to find. During many days in London, Captain Norreys and I presented our facts, conjectures, and legendary anecdotes to 5 eminent authorities, all men who could be trusted to respect any family disclosures which future explorations might develop. We found most of them little disposed to scoff, but instead intensely interested and sincerely sympathetic. It is hardly necessary to name them all, but I may say that they did include Sir William Brinton, whose excavations in the Trode excited most of the world in their day. As we all took the train to Anchester, I felt myself poised on the brink of frightful revelations, a sensation symbolized by the air of mourning among the many Americans at the unexpected death of the president on the other side of the world. On the evening of August 7th, we reached Exham Priory, where the servants assured me that nothing unusual had occurred. The cats, even the old black cat, had been perfectly placid, and not a trap in the house had been sprung. We were to begin exploring on the following day, awaiting which, I assigned well-appointed rooms to all my guests. I myself retired to the tower chamber with the old dark cat across my feet. Sleep came to me quickly, but hideous dreams assailed me. It was a vision of a Roman feast with a horror in a covered platter. Then came that damnable recurrent thing about the swineherd and his filthy drove in the twilight grotto. Yet when I awoke, it was full daylight with normal sounds in the house below. The rats, living or spectral, had not troubled me, and the old black cat was still quietly asleep. On going down, I found the same tranquility had prevailed elsewhere, a condition which one of the assembled servants, a fellow named Thornton, rather absurdly laid to the fact that I had now been shown the thing which certain forces had wished to show me. Thank you once again for joining us at the Patuxent General. If you have any questions about or would like to join us in the Gaspy Fringe Fun Fair, or dare I say a ghost story, our email is jess@patuxentgeneral.com. We'll get back to you as soon as possible. We can't wait to hear from you. But until then, I'll meet you right back here next time at the Patuxent General. Something for Posterity production, pre-recorded in Patuxent.